Je vais maintenant passer la parole, en lui souhaitant la bienvenue tout d'abord, à David Wirmer de l'Université de Cologne, qui va nous parler donc de Maïmonide et d'un des grands Andalous que nous apprécions tous, Ibn Bajjah, une des sources éventuelles d'une des figures les plus contestées, d'un des textes les plus énigmatiques d'Abélard. Mais enfin, de cela, on aura peut-être l'occasion de reparler. En tout cas, je vais vous situer tout de suite en disant que vous travaillez donc dans un lieu que je connais bien, au Thomas Institute de l'Université zu Köln, et dans un lieu qui est très important pour tous ceux qui s'intéressent à Averroès, puisque c'est là que s'élabore cette extraordinaire entreprise éditoriale qui correspond à la troisième révélation d'Averroès, selon une célèbre formule, les deux premières étant connues, à savoir l'édition critique de toutes les versions qui ont pu circuler à un moment quelconque d'Averroès dans une des langues qui ont assuré sa diffusion, autrement dit l'arabe, certes, mais aussi l'hébreu et le latin. Donc je vous passe la parole, cher David Wirmer, pour traiter de, en anglais, donc de Maïmonides and Ibn Bajjah on final causality.
Oui, merci beaucoup pour l'invitation, la possibilité de parler devant vous. Je vous présente mes excuses pour présenter cette conférence, ce texte en anglais. C'est un texte qui doit devenir un article publié en anglais, donc je vous demande votre compréhension. Peut-être je dois dire quelques mots d'abord pour situer un peu l'entreprise de cet examen. Maïmonide, l'interprétation de Maïmonide, il y a trois courants manifestes. Il y a ceux qui lisent Maïmonide comme un philosophe aristotélicien. Il y a ensuite ceux qui le lisent plutôt comme quelqu'un qui défend la foi juive contre Aristote. Et puis, il y a un groupe qui le lit comme quelqu'un qui prend une position plutôt agnostique par rapport à surtout la métaphysique. Et vous allez voir qu'avec les textes que j'étudie ici, j'essaie de présenter plutôt des arguments pour montrer que Maïmonide est bien un philosophe aristotélicien. Je commence avec une citation de Maïmonide. There is no incongruity in our saying that the existence and non-existence of all these divine acts are consequent upon his wisdom, may he be exalted. We, however, are ignorant of many of the ways in which wisdom is found in his works. It is upon this opinion that the whole of the Torah of Moses, our master, is founded. It opens with it. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And it concludes with it, the rock, his work is perfect, and so on. Know this. End of citation. Chapter 25 of the third part of Maimonides' Guide of the Perplexed, which in its final paragraph thus announces nothing less than the foundational idea of the divinely revealed law, is a chapter that rounds up and closes the discussion of divine providence, a discussion formally started in chapter 16 and prepared by several preparatory considerations beginning from chapter 8. What is at issue in chapter 25 itself is the relationship between actions and their ends, and more particularly, the question whether divine actions are performed in view of some aim or not. Broadly speaking, Maimonides argues that God's actions have to be seen as goal-directed, and more so, they have to be considered as good, an idea that he says is captured in the verse from Genesis already quoted, And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. This goodness is apparently equated with wisdom, hikmah, which, as possessed by God, is supposed to be the cause for the existence of all acts proceeding from the deity, and thus present in them. Opposed to divine wisdom is human ignorance, jahl, which fails to recognize not all, but many aspects of wisdom in the divine works. Looking somewhat closer at the passage just quoted, one notices that Maimonides interposes the mention of human ignorance between his statement that the divine actions are consequent upon wisdom and his description of this statement as foundational idea of the Torah. This order may suggest a slightly perverse, but not on the face of it, altogether improbable reading of this passage. Is it perhaps rather human ignorance of divine wisdom, which is described here as foundational for the Torah? Or is human ignorance at least included in the foundational idea? Nothing yet permits us to judge. However, we will see that much of the discussion of the good to be found in God's works is bound up with reflections on the limits of human cognition. In what follows, I want to analyze Maimonides' philosophical interpretation of the verse from Genesis in the guide and to argue that the meteorology, and especially Ibn Bajjah's commentary on the meteorology, is an important source which inspired this interpretation. We will further see that it did provide this interpretation by offering a reflection on the limits of final causality. As a first hint to the intimate link between our verse and the meteorology, I want to point to the well-known chapter 30 of book 2 of the guide, where Maimonides, while discussing the account of creation from Genesis, indicates that the meteorology can serve as a key to, as he says, extraordinary secrets, especially concerning the division of the waters below and above the firmament, then called sky, which constitute the work of the second day of creation. While Samuel ibn Tibbon, Maimonides' translator into Hebrew, use of the meteorology for interpreting the work of the water, he has a whole treatise on this, has been studied and explained convincingly as influenced by Maimonides' clue, more attention needs to be paid to the fact that Ibn Tibbon is occupied with the work of the water as continued on the third day of creation, namely the gathering of the waters which uncovers the earth, while Maimonides lays the stress on the second day and especially on the following feature of the biblical text, quote Maimonides, "Among the things you ought to know and have your attention aroused to is the reason why it is not said regarding the work of the second day that it was good." End of quote. It is then not only significant that the Torah describes God's work as good, but also that it fails to do so in some places. Maimonides duly refers to the rabbinical explanation for this omission, namely, that the work of the water continues into the third day, but he does not completely agree with this explanation. Maimonides instead suggests that the words, "it was good," could not be applied to the work of the second day because the utility of whatever was created here, he mysteriously speaks about a very great part of the existence, is not readily apparent to everyone. I quote, "For the meaning of the words that it was good is that the thing in question is of externally visible and manifest utility for the existence and permanence of that which exists. But in a matter whose meaning is hidden and that, understood in its external meaning, does not exist in such a way as to appear useful, What utility externally visible to the people at large could there be so that the words that it was good could be said with reference to it? End of quote. Rather, therefore, the work of the third day, the uncovering of the earth, was described as good, implying obviously that it is of manifest utility because it makes possible the existence of plant, animal, and human life on earth. However, we have already learned from the short passage from chapter 25, which we began, that not all the good wisely dispensed by God is recognized by human beings. What now links these considerations to meteorology? In the attempt to give at least a partial answer to this question, it seems best to turn for the time being away from Maimonides' intentionally obscure references in chapter 230 and to look at the other places where he uses and discusses our verse from Genesis, first of all, chapter 325. There, Maimonides defines a good action as the one which is accomplished by an agent aiming at a noble end, I mean, one that is necessary or useful and achieves that end. The criteria from which this definition is composed allow to distinguish good actions from those that are either futile or frivolous or vain. Vain actions are directed towards a goal without, however, attaining that goal, and thus are in sharp contrast with divine power. Frivolous actions are directed towards a base goal or towards a goal which is of lesser value than the very action itself. Maimonides uses dancing as an example. If performed not in order to keep the body healthy, but only to amuse the spectators, dancing is a frivolous action. Acting frivolous, in short, means making the higher reality subservient to the lower. It is easy then to reach agreement on the fact that God's actions are neither vain nor frivolous. This is not true, however, concerning futile actions. An action is futile if it is not goal-directed at all. And there are indeed some who hold that God's actions cannot have any aim. Maimonides takes pains to explain the reasoning behind this position. First of all, he remarks that what these people reject is the notion that God does do a thing because of another, so that there would be causes and effects in God's actions. Instead, they uphold the idea that all divine actions are dependent on the divine will alone, meaning that his willing renders superfluous the question, why did he do this? His willing not being limited by any ends. This abolition of the why question is rooted, as Maimonides describes further on, in the necessity to safeguard the teaching of creation, but it leads to absurd consequences. Quote Maimonides, "For they say, what is the end of the existence of the world as a whole? Hence they assert of necessity what everyone asserts who maintains that the world was created in time. He willed it so, there being no other cause. Thereupon they proceed to apply this assertion to all the particular things in the world. They go so far as not to concede that the hole in the uvea and the transparency of the cornea exist for the sake of letting the visual spirit pass so that it might apprehend, and do not even regard this at all as a cause of sight." End of quote. In other words, although the motive for rejecting the why question with regards to divine actions is perfectly understandable, and although this stance even seems to be required by the teaching of temporal creation, the uniform application of this principle leads into obvious error, for it means to deny, against all observation, the purposeful structure of created beings. Maimonides admits that there are some statements in the scriptures which seem to support the idea that God's actions can be explained only with reference to his inscrutable will and not at all with reference to natural dependencies between the things themselves, so that sight, for example, would have been possible without any of the organic structures actually in existence, which would then exist only because God willed it thus. Maimonides, however, gives a different turn to these statements, exalting the supremacy of God's will. They should be read to point only to the fact that nothing opposes the execution of the divine will. But in the terminology used above, these statements only confirm that the divine actions are not vain. Maimonides therefore suggests, at least in one point in chapter 25, that a description of God's actions solely in terms of divine will cannot be appropriate. Rather, he wills only what is possible, and not everything that is possible, but only that which is required by his wisdom to be such. Grounding divine action in wisdom instead of will seems to imply then that divine action is conditioned by the realm of possibility, which is independent of God. And it further seems to imply that this realm of the possible is larger than the reality created by God. In this understanding, the creation would appear to be goal-directed because it follows from the conscious selection of the most wise among all the possible orders of the world. Upon closer consideration, however, this state of affairs is not necessarily implied by the dependence of divine action on wisdom and may not be what Maimonides himself subscribed to. An earlier passage of chapter 25, presented as an argument against the frivolity of God's actions, in fact argues for a complete correspondence between the possible and the real. Quote, "The entire purpose consists in bringing into existence, the way you see it, everything whose existence is possible, since matters take their course in accordance with what his wisdom requires." End of quote. In light of this fundamental principle, as Maimonides dubs it, God's actions are not wise compared to other possible actions he could have taken but did not take. Rather, his wisdom encompasses everything that can possibly exist and does exist because of God's creative act. What makes creation the result of wisdom instead of will must therefore be some internal characteristic of the created beings. And indeed, the position that Maimonides explicitly ascribes to all those that adhere to the law and to the philosophers, and which he designates at the same time also as our own opinion, states that on the global level, quote, "the existence of the world as a whole at the moment when it came into being was necessitated by God's wisdom." And on a smaller scale, quote, "the particulars of natural acts are all well arranged and ordered and bound up with one another, all of them being causes and effects, and none of them is futile or frivolous or vain, being acts of perfect wisdom," end of quote. It seems then that, according to Maimonides, the divine actions, obviously identified with the acts of nature, are wise inasmuch as they can receive a rational explanation in terms of causes and effects. If it is this regular structure which precludes an account of the world based on will conceived as a power of arbitrary decisions. The position advocated here by Maimonides provokes the following question. Whereas the regularity of causal relationships can be convincingly used in order to describe the connections between the created beings, it is not so clear in which sense the creation of the world as a whole obeys to the same rule, unless Maimonides entertains the philosophic, and more particular Avicennan idea, of an eternal creation, or averroes, as we have heard in the preceding lecture. The world being eternally caused by God as the first cause from which all other beings follow with necessity. This suspicion is both confirmed and contradicted by the final remark which Maimonides adds to the observation from chapter 325, and this is the passage with which we began. I read again. It is upon this opinion that the whole of the Torah of Moses, our master, is founded. If you consider this opinion and the philosophic opinion, reflecting upon all the preceding chapters in this treatise that are connected with this notion, you will not find any difference between them regarding any of the particulars of everything that exists. You will find no difference other than that which we have explained, namely that they, the philosophers, regard the world as eternal, and we regard it as produced in time. Understand this. End of quote. I say that the suspicion about Maimonides' stance towards creation or eternity is confirmed because he obviously holds that the Torah's account of divine actions is entirely consonant with the philosophical account of natural acts, implying that creation does not contradict wisdom, which has been defined as providing a causal explanation. On the other hand, I say that Maimonides contradicts our suspicion because he explicitly confirms this minimal difference between philosophy and Torah regarding eternity and creation. His wording now suggests that the described causal relationships obtain only between the particular beings and not between God and the world as a whole. This, however, clearly contradicts the express attempt to describe creation as a whole as wise. It remains doubtful then what that it was good really means, and incidentally we haven't found so far any link to the meteorology. Following Maimonides' invitation to reflect on the preceding chapters of the guide, which are connected with the topic of chapter 325, we encounter one chapter which shows a particularly close connection, namely chapter 313. As announced in the opening sentence, this rather long and long-winded chapter likewise deals with the role of final causality in the world. However, whereas we have seen that chapter 325 describes, albeit in a yet inconclusive manner, goal-directedness as the pervading characteristic of the world, Maimonides here introduces the opposite claim. I quote, "Often the minds of perfect men have grown perplexed over the question of what is the final end of that which exists. Now, I will explain that in all schools, this question is abolished." End of quote. As becomes clear from what follows, the schools that Maimonides has in view are Aristotelian philosophy on the one hand and Mosaic religion on the other hand. Whoever reads chapter 313 will be struck by Maimonides' many abrupt changes of direction, switching back and forth between arguments for the paramount importance of final causality and the contrary, the idea that the final end of all that exists ought not to be sought, further complicated by several attempts to distinguish between different meanings and or aspects of final causality. In order to give you a taste of this confusing text and to finally come to the content I want to trace back to Ibn Bajjah's commentary on the meteorology, let us read a longer passage from this chapter. Quote, "For according to Aristotle's opinion as to the eternity of the world, no ultimate end should be sought for any part of the world. For all things derive, according to him, from an eternal necessity that has never ceased and will never cease. Though natural science seeks to find out the final end of every natural being, that end is not the ultimate end of which we treat in this chapter. For it is manifest, according to natural science, that every natural existent must necessarily have a final end. But that final cause, which is the noblest among the four causes, is hidden as far as the majority of species are concerned. Aristotle constantly states in an explicit way that nature does nothing in vain, meaning thereby that every natural act has a certain final end. Aristotle also states in express terms that the plants have been created for the sake of the animals. Similarly, he explains with regard to certain beings that some exist for the sake of others. He does this in particular with regard to the limbs of animals. End of quote. I hope it will be clear that neither is there an obvious connection between the different claims made here concerning Aristotle's ideas about final causality, nor do they avoid contradiction. It would take us too long to spell out all the perplexities elicited by this passage, but we can at least point to the fact that, irrespective of the possibly different senses of final cause employed, there is evident contradiction between the statement that, according to Aristotle, we must not seek the final cause for any being, and the statement that not only do they have final causes, but that Aristotle names some of these final causes. What, however, is least clear on this roller coaster on which Maimonides takes his readers is the nature of the very perplexity he proposes to combat. What makes the search for the final end of all that exists so pernicious? The answer, I propose, is not clearly apparent in the chapter itself, but can, I believe, be supported by the results from our previous discussion of chapter 325. As we saw there, the search for a final cause is problematic in one case only, namely in the case of the world as a whole, because if we subject the whole, namely the world, to the same causal explanations as the parts, meaning the different species of beings making up the world, then the meaning of creation becomes void, or is at least radically transformed, because it will then be conceived as a permanent dependency from the first cause, according to the rules of nature. Thus, although in the course of chapter 3:13, Maimonides makes every effort to give the impression that it is much more difficult to show why the search for final causes is not permitted according to the opinion of the law, the real difficulty lies with the fact that the philosophical position seems to put no limit to the quest for final causes, and can accommodate the idea that the world as a whole has a final cause, whereas the Torah position cannot. Maimonides' repeated claim that the eternity thesis makes the search for final causes meaningless is obviously specious. The idea behind this claim rests on a restricted meaning of end, aim, or goal based on the model of human action. According to this model, something which is permanent does not need and cannot have a final end purposed by the action because it is always already perfected and completed. This reasoning, first introduced by Maimonides regarding God, cannot, however, in an Aristotelian conception, be extended to the world because the latter's eternity does not annul its causatedness. You look in Physics 8, Chapter 1, Aristotle is saying this explicitly when he argues against Democritus. This is true a fortiori for the parts of the world. It is far from clear, therefore, with what justification Maimonides can ascribe to Aristotle the position that final causes, at least of a certain type, must not be sought or are hidden as far as the majority of species are concerned. It is here that I detect the influence of Ibn Bajjah's commentary on the Meteorology. In his commentary on the Meteorology, Ibn Bajjah devotes ample space to epistemological questions and notably discusses what sorts of things can be proven in this discipline and by what means. He insists that, for the most part, only a posteriori proofs are possible in meteorology. You remember what you heard about a posteriori proofs in Jean-Baptiste's lecture. Much as in other branches of the natural science, that's the means of philosophical reasoning. These are the proofs called proof of cause, because they show the cause of a phenomenon whose existence is already known from observation. In contradistinction, it is nearly impossible in meteorology and in natural science at large to construct so-called absolute proofs, as in mathematics, which determine the cause and the existence of the phenomenon at the same time. Why this is the case, Ibn Bajjah explains thus, quote, "As for the explanation of the existence of a certain species of natural bodies, which are unobserved at all, an absolute demonstration in this discipline is not possible. For if it were possible, it could only occur if the middle term were a final end or a form. Only from these two, the other things necessarily follow, and the existence of the species would necessarily follow. The forms of the natural bodies are not separate, nor do they exist through the logos. Therefore, it is not possible, as Aristotle says, to define the flesh or the bone without motion. Thus, if the form is known, the matter is known, and these two determine the ultimate species. As to the final end, we do not know it before we have got knowledge about the world as a whole. Then we know the order of that species in the world, and then one gets acquainted with the final end of that species. This only occurs after completion of natural science. Knowledge of the final ends of the ultimate species is a very difficult matter, and it is sometimes thought that it is impossible." Here you have the formula that Maimonides, so to speak, quotes. Ibn Bajjah shows then that top-down knowledge of the existence of the ultimate species of beings would be possible only according to two scenarios, both of which are counterfactual. The first scenario is the existence of Platonic ideas, that is, specific forms abstracted from matter. From these, the existence of the individuals participating in such a form could be deduced. However, inasmuch as form, according to Aristotle, is always enmattered, the form cannot be known independently of the existing material being carrying the form. The second scenario is built on the supposition that we already know the final cause of the being, for then we could deduce by hypothetical necessity the existence of the being which serves this goal. But, as Ibn Bajjah explains, knowledge of the final ends of single species is subordinate to and dependent upon knowledge of the world as a whole. For only if we have complete knowledge of natural science can we know the order that each species of being has with relation to all others. This kind of knowledge is extremely difficult to reach and therefore by some considered impossible. Ibn Bajjah's commentary on the meteorology can serve then for Maimonides as a proof that according to Aristotelian science, the question of the final end of natural kinds is, for the time being, outside the reach of human knowledge. However, at least in the present text of the commentary, Ibn Bajjah does not rule out, on principle, neither the knowledge of final ends of single species, nor for that matter, the existence of a final end for the world as a whole. Rather, the knowledge of the world as a whole seems to be what natural science is directed at. Ibn Bajjah's reflections here seem to be built on two texts, both of which Maimonides will probably have consulted together with Ibn Bajjah's commentary. The one is the text of the meteorology itself, which in chapter 12 of book 4, discusses final causality. Aristotle emphatically claims that all higher products of nature, he especially mentions the organs of the human body, have a final cause which consists in their function. On principle, Aristotle thinks this goal-directedness can be extended to all the works of nature. But practically, in beings which are closer to matter, it becomes increasingly difficult to determine this end. Aristotle thus admits that it may be difficult in general to know the final end of natural kinds. The second relevant text is Al-Farabi's Philosophy of Aristotle, which, apparently based on the metrology passage in question, mentions the problem of determining final ends several times. Because of time, I cannot here go into details. Let us turn back briefly to Maimonides now in order to get a deeper understanding of the goodness or goal-directedness of creation described in the verse from Genesis. Maimonides, as we already saw in our long extract from chapter 3:13 of the Guide, distinguishes, not unlike Ibn Baja, this time in his commentary on the Physics, a first from an ultimate utility of every species. Quote Maimonides, "According to Aristotle, the first finality of every individual produced in time consists in the perfection of the form of the species. Consequently, every individual in whom the act necessary deriving from that form are perfected has achieved its finality perfectly and completely. The ultimate finality of the species is the permanence of this form through the continuance of generation and corruption, so that there should always be a new process of generation in which the greatest possible perfection is sought." End of quote. Concerning this ultimate finality, Maimonides bases his claim probably on remarks which Aristotle makes in De Anima or in De Generatione et Corruptione. In the course of chapter 3:13, Maimonides associates the first aspect of the final end, the perfection of the species form, with the repeated biblical statement that it was good, and the second aspect, continuity, with the verse, "Behold, it was very good," very designating the permanence of the species form. According to this interpretation, there would indeed be no external finality linking the different natural kinds among each other. However, this is only part of the story, for Maimonides introduces a further biblical verse in order to describe the radical ambivalence of his result. Quote, "The Lord has made everything lema'anehu," meaning either for its sake or for his sake. So one can read, "The Lord has made everything for its sake," or "The Lord has made everything for his sake." Both interpretations are true. In a way, everything exists for its own sake as part of the permanent structure of the cosmos. But on the other hand, the single species forming this structure certainly have to have purposeful relationships among each other, as appeared from chapter 3:25, and as Maimonides says several times in chapter 3:13 too, you remember the case of plants being created for animals to eat. Only, this way of looking at things is licit only from the point of view of divine causality. Only from there can one understand the world as a whole, and therefore appreciate the place of every species in that whole. Looking back now on Maimonides' mysterious allusion in chapter 2:30, we can hazard a guess on his intended meaning. In this earlier chapter, the goodness of created beings had not yet been defined with reference to God or even with reference to their own nature, but with reference to their utility for human beings. Therefore, it couldn't be said concerning the work of the second day of creation, including the creation of the sky, that it was good, because the heavens are not merely useful, nor do they even exist for the sake of permanent generation and corruption, rather the other way around, although these processes are a necessary consequence of their existence. But rather, the heavens are far nobler than the rest of the world, they are not subject to generation and corruption themselves. They may even be divine. Thank you.